One of my dad's greatest heroes was Dorothy Day and the Catholic worker movement. That was central to the fight for the five-day work week and an end to child labor. I mean, again, that's another area where Christians have made a positive impact in American society. And the Catholic worker movement still inspires me to this day, because Dr. King died in Memphis because he was there using the teachings of Jesus to help a garbage man strike. I mean, organized labor is one of these issues. People who are economically strapped, it's literally Jesus' favorite thing to talk about. It's like at every one of his live shows. It's like his Layla.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Concer, and I'm joined today by a comedian, actor, writer, and broadcaster. He's been featured in the road trip film Dream On, appeared on your TV everywhere from VH1 to MSNBC. And since 2015, he's been hosting the progressive talk show Tell Me Everything. And he has a book out. It's called Separation of Church and Hate, A Sane Person's Guide to Taking Back the Bible from Fundamentalists, Fascists, and Flock-Fleecing Frauds. John Fugelsang, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Oh, thank you, SW. I'm very glad to be here and to drag your show down to my level. Thank you so much.
Well, both you and I are preacher's kids. Your origin story, though, is a lot more interesting than mine.
I don't know about that. I mean, you're a real preacher's kid. My mother was a nun, and she grew up in the segregated South, entered the convent right out of high school. They put her through nursing school. That was her way out of poverty. And the convent sent her to work with lepers in Malawi, Africa. My father was a Franciscan brother from Brooklyn, who was very Dorothy Day, social justice, civil rights Catholic. And he fell madly in love with this nun he met before she went to Africa, carried a torch for 10 years, finally got her to leave. So, I mean, you know, my father was a brother, my mother was a sister. You're a real preacher's kid. So I'm son of a nun.
Well, you say at the beginning of your book, I'm here because two people broke a promise to God.
I was about 11 years old when I learned what a vow of celibacy was. And that was the first time I really got serious about Catholic guilt and understanding that, wow, I'm not supposed to be here. My parents made this promise that I would never happen, and I'm living proof that they broke an oath. And it was great to have my first existential dread. Some people put that off till middle age, but I got started early.
Well, I've seen you in conversation with W. Kamau Bell and with Stephen Colbert. Both of them are churchgoers, devout in their own way, and they both share your distaste for so-called Christian nationalists.
Well, you know, it's just going by the Jesus parts of the Bible. And I wrote this book because I grew up believing that Christianity was about the things that Christ taught and commanded during those three brief years he spent healing people and teaching. Welcome the stranger. Love your enemies. Forgive everybody. Individuals and nations must care for the poor and the sick, Matthew 25, and be kind to those in prison as well. Pay your damn taxes. Stop executing people unless you've never sinned in your entire life. And like millions, I grew up to sort of feel in the 80s and 90s that post the moral majority and the rise of Falwell and the televangelists, that this religion of peace and love had kind of been hijacked by this mean little pro-apartheid, white supremacist, tax-free clique. I remember watching these guys, Falwell and Pat Robertson and Swagger on TV. They never talked about loving your enemy. They talked about who your enemy was. And they would talk about AIDS patients and welfare queens and gay people and always punching down at the marginalized, never lifting them up. They never attacked racism as an anti-Jesus evil. They attacked protests against racism. As a kid, it was really awkward to be told I was the same religion as these people. And a lot of folks have had this experience. By the time I got to college in the 90s, if you told somebody you were Christian in New York City, where I was, they automatically assumed that you hated gay people. They automatically assumed that you thought the government should force pregnant women to be pregnant by rape against their will. Christianity's been given a bad name. And it's not because of Jesus or God or Noah's Ark or Santa Claus. Young people are leaving organized religion because they're turned off to the meanness and the cruelty. You can maybe use this homophobia or beating up on migrants to keep a certain 20th century demographic packing your pews, but it's not attractive to young people. So I wrote this book for everybody who's tired of seeing this religion of love now hijacked and used as a cloaking device for hatred. And I wanted to go through every issue that divides us as a society. From women's reproductive rights to LGBTQ equality to gun control to biblical literalism to poverty policy, healthcare policy, sexual hangups and prejudice. Every issue that divides us and show how, even if you're an atheist, if you're debating a Christian nationalist, Jesus is probably on your side because Jesus's movement was all about humility, servant leadership, taking care of those beneath you. It was not about total right-wing domination of the school board. And Christian nationalism and fundamentalism has nothing to do with the teachings of Christ. They don't fight for anything Jesus actually says. They legislate against Jesus's actual teachings. Their goal is power. That's it. They want earthly power because they think God likes them better and they're entitled to it. And our media culture and the Democratic Party have allowed these folks to set terms that Jesus himself would have rejected. No one ever asked Mike Pence, where does Jesus chase the gay wedding cakes out of the temple? No one ever asks anyone in the MAGA movement, can you name me one teaching of Jesus that the MAGA movement has ever fought for, politically or legislatively? One. You ask them and they'll say abortion. Well, the Bible's not against abortion. God asserts, as your listeners know, that a fetus is property in Exodus 21, and a woman's life has more value in God's eye. Jesus's religion doesn't ban abortion. It's why they're legal and free in Israel right now. And then they'll say, well, strong border. And that's what I always got to say. The God of the Hebrew scriptures commands us to welcome the stranger and will not let us mistreat the alien. We must treat the alien as one of our own. His son Jesus shows up, if you believe this book, in Matthew 25 and says, individuals and nations will be judged by how they welcome the stranger, heaven or hell. So I gotta say, don't fight these people. Let them fight the Bible. When they're calling these people illegals, when we should be calling them Christian refugees, I say, why should I listen to you and Donald Trump and reject God and Jesus? Don't fight about anything. Just say, this is what God says. This is what Jesus says. Tell me why Stephen Miller is right and God and Jesus are wrong. Let these fundamentalists argue against the Bible and let them do it at the cookout. You don't need to fight them. You don't need to hate them back. You can model turning the other cheek. But if you have someone like this in your family, I find engaging them on scripture gets you a lot farther than calling them a bigot or superstitious or brainwashed. They'll just think you're on the side of Satan. They may appreciate that you actually engage with them on scripture. And look at how many of us have talked so many parents and grandparents out of homophobia over the last 30 years. So I'm a big believer that you'll get farther with right-wing Christians showing how Jesus wasn't an immigrant-hating homophobe than if you just call them an immigrant-hating homophobe. Because this progress is not going to come from politicians and it's not going to come from the media. It's got to come from us, the people who know what the Bible actually says and are tired of seeing it weaponized against the least of us.
Well, like you said, this book is wide-ranging. You quote the Hebrew scriptures, you quote the Gospels, you make arguments and a lot of witty quips along the way. Clearly, though, yeah, it can be tiring to defend your faith from the people who have dressed it up in assault weapons and toxic masculinity.
It can be, but I think once you know a few basics and you can engage these people without anger, without hating them, let them rage, and you can be the calmest person in the room. It takes some practice, but you can get there. But if you know the right questions to ask, instead of the names to call them, but you know the right questions to ask on any subject, on immigration, on abortion, on what does Christ actually say about LGBTQ rights? And these people quote Leviticus and they pretend that Christians follow Leviticus. They'll all say Leviticus 18, man with man's an abomination. Well, Leviticus 20:10 commands you to kill all adulterers with rocks. So I'll let you settle that with Donald Trump. They don't actually follow the Bible, these folks, and they're counting on the rest of us not knowing the Bible that well. So I wrote this book for anybody who wants to reclaim that goodness of the faith. I wrote this book about what Christianity started out as, what it turned into, and why the best parts of it are still worth fighting for.
Yeah, you have a chapter. This is a fun chapter where you coined the term warrior bro dude Jesus. And the religious right, they idolize an image of Jesus that more closely resembles Thor. And not just in the blonde hair, but also in the rippling muscles and the weaponry.
Oh yeah, the Prince of Peace who packs a piece. Yeah, this alpha bro Christ that does not appear anywhere in the Gospels. And I trace it back to the Crusades. That was really where Jesus's movement officially became an imperial force that could slaughter marginalized groups. That was when the movement of Christ was completely corrupted, and this whole belief that we can violate all the teachings of Christ as long as we impose this religion on those peoples. As we saw with slavery, as we saw with indigenous people, being saved didn't save anybody. And you look at this jackass Fox News prompter monkey drunk sex abusing clown, Pete Hegseth. Please don't cut any of that out. You look at this miscreant with his Deus Vult tattoo. God wills it. Well, that's what they said back then. God wills it. They're really drawing heavily on Hebrew scriptures they don't follow because Christ wills something very different than violent domination. If you're using violence to spread the word of Christ, you stop caring about the word of Christ a long time ago. This is the guy who, when they came to arrest him and his friends wanted to practice self-defense, he said, "Put away your swords. He who lives by the sword will die by the sword." And they're always looking for a Jesus loophole. Always. They don't want to follow this guy. That's why they never quote Jesus on a classroom wall or a courthouse wall. They don't want to follow him. They want to worship him. They want to make you worship him, but they don't want to listen. They want to fight for him. They don't want to listen to him. And this is what they're imposing on us, their very narrow Christ-free version of worshiping Christ. I mean, it's like if you're in a Rolling Stones cover band and you advertise yourself as a Rolling Stones cover band and you only do songs by Nickelback and Vanilla Ice. Maybe it's time to get a new name for your group. That's all I'm saying.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we're talking today with comedian, actor, writer, and broadcaster John Fugelsang. He's been featured in the road trip film Dream On, performed off-Broadway and all over cable TV, and been a contributor to Current TV and HuffPost. His book is called Separation of Church and Hate: A Sane Person's Guide to Taking Back the Bible from Fundamentalists, Fascists, and Flock Fleecing Frauds. There is an NPR interview with Russell Moore, the editor-in-chief at Christianity Today. Oh, you've heard this one. He said,
"Oh, yeah."
multiple pastors tell me the same story about quoting Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, and to have somebody come up after to say, "Where did you get those liberal talking points?" The pastor would say, "I'm literally quoting Jesus Christ." And the response would be, "Yes, but that doesn't work anymore. That's weak."
Yeah. So again, folks, they're not Christ followers. You can't follow the teachings of Christ and support the policies of Trump. Ask them, chapter and verse, show me the teachings of Jesus that Trump or the MAGA movement fight for. Show me the actual gospel commandments of Christ that the Republican Party has fought for in this century. Let's go back 50 years to Nixon and the Earned Income Tax Credit. Since then, show me where the Republican Party has specific, I mean, I was talking to someone on my SiriusXM show last night about the programs and all the work that Turning Point USA did for the unfortunate Mr. Kirk. And I said, "Did Turning Point USA ever do anything for the poor? How do they fight poverty? How do they fight to help the sick? How did they fight to welcome the stranger?" They didn't do those things. They called those things Marxism and globalism and open borders. So if they're going to stand in your house and weaponize scripture they don't believe in against marginalized groups that the Christ they don't follow commands them to love, we've got a First Amendment right to call them out for it because the media is not going to do it and the Democratic Party's too scared. We don't have to do it with hate. We can't hate them back. But in a democracy, we have to beat them. And if they're going to wrap themselves up in the pages of this Bible to have this false piety, then it's up to us to show all the bystanders these people are frauds, they're blasphemers, they don't believe in anything Jesus actually talked about. They're using his name for power. Liberals don't have to believe in Jesus to win on this.
We did mention the Sermon on the Mount, and for those of our listeners who spent their weekends somewhere other than Sunday school, give us a rundown on the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. They're the inspiration for the word beatific, also for the beat poets.
Yeah. You know, the Sermon on the Mount is the sort of thing they teach us as kids before we're old enough to really appreciate what it is and what it means and what he's saying, and that it's really Jesus's spiritual manifesto of social justice and ethics and compassion and empathy. I like to say that this is like his Woodstock, and it's important to use the Sermon on the Mount against Christian nationalism. It is the most direct, nonviolent way you can oppose Christian nationalism by quoting Jesus's most famous public appearance, because it is all about humility over any sense of spiritual superiority, spiritual authority. If these people are trying to fight for power and claiming that they are authority spiritually to impose something, they stopped being Jesus followers a long time ago. It calls for us to reject all forms of vengeance, even when someone desperately deserves it. I mean, Jesus overturns eye for an eye in the Sermon on the Mount. You can't support the death penalty and brag about how much you believe in Jesus. He never mentions abortion. He comes out against killing the sinner multiple times, even says that only sinless people can execute, and commands us to forgive 70 times 7. I mean, look at the Sermon on the Mount. Love your enemies. Do not judge other people ever. The golden rule. And then the Beatitudes, which is this list of blessings he gives, that it's really beautiful. I mean, it's all about focusing on the less fortunate. It's all about the poor and marginalized. And it doesn't seem like a very political thing until you consider that this guy was living under military occupation in Roman-occupied Judea. These people had lost their freedom. These Hebrews had soldiers with guns and fortresses, and they were executing Jews out in public in the most humiliating of ways. And this guy shows up and he says, you know, blessed are the poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You know, blessed are the meek, they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they will be filled, without ever directly taking on the Roman Empire. He directly spoke to this crowd that was living in a state of perpetual outrage and grief over this. And he didn't preach it for violence. Blessed are the pure in heart, they'll see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, they'll be called the children of God. He was calling out their evil, but he wasn't calling to respond with evil. He's saying, when they strike you, turn the other cheek. It's exactly what Gandhi said. It's exactly what MLK said, because violence doesn't work against authoritarians. They want you to be violent. They want to crush you. I wrote this book because I think the only things that work against these fake Christians, these spiritual authoritarians, these bullies, it's nonviolence, humor, actual scripture, and democracy. When we're witnessing now, some guy who may have been right wing trying to stop a Christian nationalist with a bullet, it's only going to make things worse.
You posted about the murder of Charlie Kirk, and you say, do these idiots even realize that shooting Charlie Kirk makes you a worse person than Charlie Kirk? You did get some pushback on that.
Yeah, quite a bit. I got the right wing attacked me for 48 hours straight on Twitter, and the left wing attacked me for 48 hours straight on Blue Sky. I've never had that happen with such ferocity from one tweet from different extremes. But I was attacked by the right for saying that you're worse the person than Charlie Kirk, because how could you say that Charlie Kirk wasn't a wonderful person? Well, I'll get to that. The evidence is out there. And then the right was mad because, of course, you should kill Nazis. The left rather was mad at me. These extreme left guys were mad at me because I'm being sympathetic to Charlie Kirk's racism and homophobia by saying that the dude shouldn't have been murdered unarmed. And I'm like, oh my God, really? I'm sorry, you cease to be able to call yourself liberal when you're trying to rationally argue for murdering an unarmed person because of his vile opinions. Like, you go far enough to the left or the right, and it's the same nut jobs. And in both cases, they're avoiding talking about the fact that all of these shootings, It's the same thing time and time again. It's 20 something guys, too much time online, alienated, and guns are easily available. This guy doesn't seem to have actually been doing this for any certain political team. Just like the 20 something Republican kid with a gun who shot at Trump, just like the 20 something white kid who killed the Luigi Mangione, who, he wasn't really, he was doing an act of political terrorism. He wasn't really playing for one particular dodgeball team and doing it.
Well, I do wonder
So,
if it wasn't more of the tone than the content. I mean, guys like us, the cishet guys with pale complexions, it's possible that we can't fully appreciate the real pain that marginalized groups feel when they're surrounded all the time by violent rhetoric.
well, you know what? It's too bad if we can't, but it's no excuse if we can't. A lack of empathy is being sold as a virtue now, and that's fine. That's legal. Don't pretend you're Christian if you do it. The thing for me was that, and I want to remind progressive and liberal people about, yes, all the awful stuff this guy said is true, right? I mean, vile racism. He took delight in the murder of George Floyd. He took delight and pleasure in the murder of an unarmed man on camera for his whole family to see the murder. And he took delight in mocking Nancy Pelosi's elderly husband taking a hammer to the face. And yes, he said demeaning things about black people and black women, and just celebrated violence and thought that we should execute. I mean, he thought we should murder Joe Biden. He thought Joe Biden should be executed. So all this horrible stuff, right? Yeah, he said it. I get it. But here's the thing. That stuff's going to be there forever. And these two sides that are fighting right now, trying to win on this, when in reality, maybe the shooter wasn't fighting for either one of these two sides. And no doubt the right wing's refusal to have responsible gun legislation is making all these shootings easier. So I have no problem placing more blame in that area. But Charlie Kirk is going to have his racist statements stapled to his obituary for a rest of time, right? His kids are going to grow up and they're going to be told what a great guy their dad is. And at some point, they're going to see the millions of internet memes revealing the other side of their dad. And Charlie Kirk is never going to get to turn 33 or 34. He's never going to get to grow up. He's never going to get to become a man. Watch Trumpism fail. He's never going to get to be knocked down and lose some investors and lose arguments, lose debates. He's never going to be challenged and have to find something stronger in himself and rise up again. And he is never going to get to have a black friend now, or a gay friend, or a transgender friend, or an immigrant friend who can help open his mind and open his heart. He's never going to get to have a Muslim friend that makes him realize how stupid his bigotry was. And again, the bigotry was the point. Charlie Kirk was well compensated for normalizing racism and white supremacy to college students and people in their 20s. That was the whole thing. This is the Confederacy. This is Seven Mountain Mandate. This is white supremacy, all of it. I'm not disputing any of that. I'm just saying that this guy's never going to get to become a better person now. And that's the real tragedy, because I said horrible things when I was younger. Most of us have. And I'm lucky enough that I've had a chance to grow and be a little less screwed up. Charlie Kirk's not going to get to do that now. And the worst parts of him are going to be locked in stone, and he's never going to get to balance it out. So let's not contribute to that by letting our hatred for another point of view cloud our sense of how we're supposed to treat each other. You can call people out and call out hypocrisy without hatred and without violence. I recommend comedy and scripture. It's the safest way to do it.
Do not be conformed, but be transformed.
That's Jesus's whole message, evolve. I wish the creationists would realize that, but his whole thing is not about condemnation. It's all about transformation and having a better spirituality than you used to have, and going deeper into the religion you have, deeper into it. That's what transforming it is. When he says, "I came to fulfill the law," go deeper into your religion to find a deeper kind of love. And that's the revolution he talks about. And that's the sort of thing that you don't do in groups.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. And we're talking today with comedian, actor, writer, and broadcaster John Fugelsang. He's been featured in the road trip film Dream On, performed off-Broadway and all over cable TV, and been a contributor to Current TV and HuffPost. His book is called Separation of Church and Hate: A Sane Person's Guide to Taking Back the Bible from Fundamentalists, Fascists, and Flock-Fleecing Frauds. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to thank our listeners for helping reach the goal for our KBOO Out Loud membership drive. If you didn't get a chance to contribute, we could still use your help. You may have heard that the powers that be have succeeded in killing off the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's a serious blow for democracy and free speech. But it doesn't mean that all is lost for community radio. Yes, the billionaires would love to silence the voice of communities like ours. Taking over the public airwaves is high on the wish list of the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. But you have the power to stand against the oligarchs, and supporting KBOO Radio is a great start. There are all kinds of ways to join KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, John Fugelsang. Yeah, so the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, that's central to the gospel message. And you point out in the book that the fundamentalists are all about posting the Ten Commandments in all the public places.
Yes, sir.
But they seem to have zero interest in posting the Beatitudes.
And by the way, next time you're arguing with your right-wing Christian Trump lover, just say, what's your favorite Beatitude? What part of the Sermon on the Mount do you think Donald Trump most exemplifies? They don't follow Jesus. You can put up a tree in your house once a year and believe you're better than other people because you accept him as your savior. That's really convenient spirituality. It's actually spiritual narcissism. Following Jesus isn't easy. I mean, he's such a woke do-gooder. It's kind of irritating, but he says it's not. You have to pick up your cross and follow him. It's not supposed to be convenient and easy and we're on top and we're number one and we dominate because our religion's the best and the Constitution doesn't apply to us because God's bigger than the founding fathers. I mean, it's all narcissism and none of it comes from Christ. We got to call it out because these people are trying to impose this rancid mutation of a movement of love into every aspect of our civic and social life. And they're full of crap. And that's the good news. We can beat them without hating them.
If there's a common theme in Jesus's preaching, it would be recognizing the humanity in other people, the divine spark, if you will. So the one thing that it seems Jesus would actually consider taboo would be the dehumanization and exploitation of other people.
I would agree. Among many things he would deem taboo, but yes.
And one of the things that you take out in the book is you have no use for the idea of scriptural literalism. That seems to be a relic of later influences, Hellenistic interpretation, Western Enlightenment thinking.
I think literalism is a tool of authoritarianism. And anyone who claims that they believe every word of the Bible is literal fact either hasn't read it or they're lying because they think you haven't read it. I mean, do you believe that you should stone people to death for picking up sticks on Saturday? You know, I mean, I go through in a passage on literalism how there's a lot of truth in the Bible. It's a beautiful book with many, many truths. There's not a lot of facts in the Bible. And when we fight to prove the literal reality of this book, which was many books written by many men, each of them giving their impression of what God is, when we fight to say that you absolute literal belief in this is what qualifies your spiritual integrity, we're missing the entire point of Jesus's message. And Jesus constantly calls out the conservative religious bosses of his day for their focus on the letter of the law and missing the point of love itself. I mean, again, I think that there's so much in the Bible that clearly is not meant to be taken literally. And we got people fighting about a talking snake. What does belief, literal belief in a talking snake, have to do with anything Jesus taught us about? What is literal belief that God formed the first woman from a man's rib and that even though women give life, men did it first? What is believing that as literal fact? What is believing in a 6,000-year-old earth and thinking that you've got to fight? What is putting women in jail for ending a pregnancy? What does any of that have to do with the ministry and teachings of Jesus? You don't have to believe in any of this as literal fact to ask these people this question. And again, Jesus, it's like he didn't end the parable by saying the moral of this story is the Good Samaritan was a totally real guy and everything in this story actually happened, the end. No, literal belief, rote obedience is not the point of the story. And that's why Jesus told his truths in stories rather than preaching, because he wanted to convey truths in ways that would get the point home and that people would remember. You'd remember the point of the parable of the lost sheep. And it was a great way of imparting spiritual messages to folks who might not be as educated as everyone else. He was a terrific teacher and storyteller. And to me, if you're just worshiping the miracles and saying we have to believe in 2,000-year-old accounts of supernatural acts to prove you really have faith in Jesus, but love your enemy, that's just our Jesus being all metaphorical and stuff. I'm not obliged to take your claims of piety seriously.
Right, you point out that what's literal about a parable? Was Jesus a door or was he the bread of life? He told
Yeah, the
people
man
both of
is
those
not
things.
made of flour and yeast, folks. He's a poet. He's not made of flour and yeast. Exactly. I mean, when they say no one comes to the Father but through me, right? That's their favorite one to say that all the Hindus are in hell and Jews are in hell and the indigenous people of North America and the Muslims are all burning in hell with Gandhi and Malcolm X because you weren't the right. I'm the right, but you're all because no one comes to the Father but through me. And I love. So what do you mean? Like we have to physically pass through Jesus's rib cage? Ask them that. We have to physically pass through Jesus's physical body to do that? And they'll say disgustedly, no, what are you talking about? And you say, oh, so you're saying Jesus was speaking metaphorically when he said, no one comes to the Father but through me. He wasn't saying literally through my body. He was speaking metaphorically, meaning belief in my divinity and belief in my teachings, right? Those two things. Now, if all you believe in is his divinity, and you think that makes you better than anybody else because you worship this guy, but you vote against his teachings and legislate against his teachings and don't bother to know his teachings while claiming ownership of it. Well, then, I mean, that's the problem with right-wing Christianity, and it always has been. Christianity was used to justify the Crusades and it was so many evils throughout history, but the important part is it's always been the Christ followers who've pushed back. So Christianity gives us the Crusades and violence against smaller religions and Christ followers, like Saint Francis of Assisi left the battlefield and preached against war. So Christianity gives us the doctrine of discovery, and we're raping foreign lands and torturing indigenous people and stealing their resources, but it's okay because we're making them become Christian. And Columbus is slaughtering the Taíno people in the shadow of the cross, but it was a Christ follower. The Catholic priest on his boat, Bartolomeo de las Casas, who wrote to the Queen protesting the treatment of indigenous, the first act of protest by a white person in this hemisphere. And it was a Catholic priest against Columbus. I was never taught this in Sunday school growing up. This is the sort of thing you'd think Christians could be proud of. Slavery propped up by Christianity and its Christ followers like Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, the Quakers, who formed the abolitionist movement. I mean, I could go on. I mean, Bonhoeffer pushing back against the Christians who gave us the Holocaust. Reverend Martin Luther King using scriptures against the Christianity that gave us segregation. This is the entire history of the faith. There's an inspiring, amazing history of Christian activism, and it's always manifested itself in resistance to authoritarian Christianity.
And for people who take scripture at face value, Jesus's command to welcome the stranger would seem like a slam dunk for your side of the debate, especially combined with all of the Torah commands to treat foreigners with justice. You do a big chapter on this.
I'm not saying that societies shouldn't have standards and regulations on who enters the country. I mean, of course, although God doesn't recognize any of these invisible lines in the ground we create. I mean, I want to see a lot of these folks arguing to Jesus that they defended Trump immigration policy because borders are sacred. I really want to see that conversation someday in heaven. But again, to me, it's the criminalization of migrants. A lot of these people are fleeing violence from our drug war in Central America, which is still going on. I've done stand-up in El Salvador and Honduras for the troops. We have troops there because the drug war is still going on. And these are people fleeing violence that we're helping perpetuate. Also, if you're standing on American soil, you're legally allowed to claim asylum. So I don't know where the illegals part comes in. Also, this demonization of undocumented people, well, if they were really serious about it, they make it a felony to hire an undocumented person and start locking up these Caucasians who put a giant help wanted sign at our border. They're not going to stop crossing the border because we're not taking down the help wanted sign. Trump's already given a waiver for agricultural workers, people who are here because we won't pay Americans a living wage to pick our food, but will exploit economically marginalized brown people. And the White House has officially taken a break from its racism to sanction this racism. This is how serious they are about it. If they wanted it to stop, they'd lock up the employers. They're not doing it. They'd have to put Donald Trump in jail going back to the 80s. So this is the hypocrisy they're pushing, and that's how you know it's all a racist scam to get votes. So we're calling them illegals? They're Christian refugees. And again, it's not saying I believe in open borders to call out this grotesque hypocrisy. Tell me how you follow Trump on immigration and Jesus at the same time. Just ask them, make them argue with God.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we're talking today with comedian, actor, writer, and broadcaster John Fugelsang. He's been featured in the road trip film Dream On, performed off-Broadway and all over cable TV, and been a contributor to Current TV and HuffPost. His book is called Separation of Church and Hate, A Sane Person's Guide to Taking Back the Bible from Fundamentalists, Fascists, and Flock-Fleecing Frauds. You know, in America, religious institutions are not taxed. And there's a famous quote by Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard. You don't get rich writing science fiction. If you want to get rich, you start a religion.
Or a cult. Don't count out the cults. Let's hear it for the indies, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at most well-funded institutions these days that use the word Christian, you could more accurately substitute the word corporate, like the Christian Coalition in the U.S. or the Christian Democrats
Absolutely.
in European parliaments. Of course, calling them
Absolutely.
corporate Democrats would be a lot less popular.
And it's always been this way. I mean, you know, one of my dad's greatest heroes was Dorothy Day and the Catholic worker movement. That was central to the fight for the 5-day work week and an end to child labor. I mean, again, that's another area where Christians have made a positive impact in American society. And the Catholic worker movement still inspires me to this day because Dr. King died in Memphis because he was there using the teachings of Jesus to help a garbage man strike. I mean, organized labor is one of these issues. People who are economically strapped, it's literally Jesus's favorite thing to talk about. It's like at every one of his live shows, it's like his Layla, you know, that's his favorite thing. And yet, I guess that's why conservative Christians are always talking about helping the poor, isn't it? The thing Jesus talked about the most, he never mentioned abortion. Never said to be mean to gay people. Pretty much says gay men are born that way in Matthew 19. Never said be cruel to immigrants. He said constantly to care for the poor and prioritize the poor. Where is that messaging coming from any sector of American conservative Christianity?
You know, you talk about the Catholic worker movement and all of the civil rights organizations. I mean, a lot of that came about in the early 20th century. Christian socialism was a thing
Exactly.
that was taking off, and it became a huge movement all during the Progressive Era and the Great Depression. The thing is, that really spooked the captains of industry, and they recruited evangelists who would preach the good news of capitalism, like Billy Graham and Fulton
Exactly.
Sheen.
Yeah, propagandists. The Nazis did the same thing. The Nazis put out Bibles that said that Jesus wasn't really Jewish. You can always get some hack clergy to bend to your will in exchange for a generous check for their ministry. So it's propaganda, and we see it now. I mean, look at the Christians who have appeared with Donald Trump at his many public events. Look at the famous Christian celebrities and these prancing loons like Sean Foyt who dance around stage peacocking and never talking about anything Christ ever stressed. Donald Trump didn't get the evangelicals to join him because he promised to do the things Christ did. Go ahead.
Well, white evangelicals.
Right, correct. But Donald Trump never got conservative white Christians to vote for him by saying, I'm going to do the things Jesus commands of us. I'm going to fight for our Lord's word. He never talked about the things Jesus said. Donald Trump pandered to white American conservative Christianity by saying they're under siege. And he played up the persecution narrative. Because I don't know if your listeners know this, but white Christians are still the most dominant religious group in the country, and they dominate government and the legal sector and private industry and tech. White Christians, we're doing okay, but The persecution narrative is what unites fundamentalist Islam, fundamentalist Judaism, fundamentalist Christianity. We're always victims, right? Because if we're always victims, it justifies any cruelties we do. So Donald Trump never appealed to them by talking about how I'm going to be a steward of Christ. He said, you guys have been picked on and you deserve to be on top. He sold the illusion of earthly power to these white Christian people and that you deserve to run this country. And we all know what the subtext is there.
Well, and it's the same people who have made the poor rural white population more poor and rural.
Yes, you're right. Exactly. But until we can convince these people that they have more in common with poor and working black folks than they have in common with rich white billionaires, we're going to see this. I mean, this is class division, and religion has always been used to control population, not Jesus. Jesus came to break the chains. And that's why Jesus was so threatening to the authoritarians of his day. And Jesus is so threatening to the authoritarians of our time. His message is still horrific, which is why they surround themselves with these peacocks and frauds who will never talk about Jesus's actually message. That's how they neutralize him. They turn him into a marble statue. It's like they do with MLK. MLK's words are still dangerous to the establishment, but we've reduced him to this holiday, and people forget how dangerous he. Oh, Malcolm X was dangerous. No, MLK was more dangerous to the establishment than Malcolm X because he was going to use morality to go, and so did Malcolm as well. Malcolm X certainly used spirituality and morality as well, but MLK was so subversive. He was despised at the time he died, and now he's a plush toy. We used to feel good about ourselves, like Jesus. The actual Jesus is a radical activist. And he's not interested in how much money you give your church, or how much you scream at women outside clinics, or how much you pray, or how devoted you are, or how often he cares in Matthew 25 about four things. Did you take care of the poor, take care of the sick, welcome the stranger, be kind to prisoners, individuals and nations? And conservative Christians never talk about that. They'll never post that or the Beatitudes on any buildings. So it's not that hard for us, without hating them, to elegantly point out that their emperor has no clothes and that the whole movement is based on a misreading of the gospel. And Jerry Falwell weaponized this. They never mentioned abortion until Falwell never mentioned abortion in a sermon until 5 years after Roe v. Wade. The whole 70s, they never used it. You know what they used? The Jimmy Carter's IRS was going after universities that still practiced racial segregation. And Falwell was a segregationist. I never knew that growing up watching him on TV because the TV never told me he was a damn segregationist. But he'd opened up whites-only schools. And through the 70s, their mission was to go after Jimmy Carter's IRS, which is interfering in private Christian universities. Jimmy Carter's IRS was suing them when it said to the Mormons, we're going to take away your tax-exempt status if you're bloody racist and if you practice discrimination. Ronald Reagan talked more about Jimmy Carter's IRS than he talked about abortion in the campaign. And then it didn't test well. Most people didn't care. Abortion, that caught on. And so for 45 years, we've seen two generations of American Christians groomed to prioritize things Jesus never talked about, far above all the things Jesus actually talked about.
So abortion is a shibboleth, you're saying, and in the book you mentioned that it actually the practice goes back thousands of years.
It existed in Jesus's time, it's well documented. And God never saw fit to comment on it. God never saw fit to have Moses or Elijah or Jeremiah. They quote Jeremiah, but he didn't talk about it. God never saw fit to have Christ or Peter or Paul or any of the prophets ever talk about ending a pregnancy, forbid it, or explain what the penalty should be for ending a pregnancy. If two guys are fighting and one guy's wife reaches out and touches the other man's genitals, her hand gets cut off. They thought of that. God goes in Leviticus through every kind of possible incest relationship you can have that he's going to forbid. He goes into like grandnieces with uncles and grandparents. Nothing about ending a pregnancy. And yet they got the followers of Jesus to reject everything Christ ever talked about over something Christ never talked about.
Another thing you mentioned in the book that Jesus never talked about was same-sex relations. You make the same point that Jimmy Carter made, that same-sex relationships were very much the norm in Roman-occupied Judea and surroundings, and Jesus would have been well aware of this at the time.
This was the guiding chapter for the book. There's no part of the Bible anyone can use to ever say that same-sex relationships are wrong. There's no part of the Bible anyone can use to say that same-sex relationships are wrong. No part. Because these people don't follow Leviticus. They don't, and Leviticus is about keeping your tribe's numbers up, right? That's why there's no incest, don't have sex on your period, don't hook up with other guys. It's keep your numbers up. We're in the desert for 40 years. There's no Wi-Fi. There's no antibiotics, guys. There's no penalty ever given that we're told about. No one's ever stoned to death in Leviticus for having sex with another guy. We just hear the law. We're never told if anyone ever did it, right? But Jesus brought a new covenant. Leviticus doesn't apply to us. That's why Gentiles get to enjoy bacon. That's why you're having pork chops now. That's how Paul sold the religion to the Gentiles, that it's not basic Judaism. Keep your foreskin. I mean, so literally, Christians don't follow Leviticus. Christ brings a new covenant, and Jesus is very specific about how we're supposed to treat each other, especially the least of these and those who have less power than us. I argue in the book that the story of the Roman centurion, and this is a very common theory, that that's actually not about a Roman centurion wanting a slave to be healed.
We're talking about a Roman centurion who comes up to Jesus while he's hanging out with his
Yeah.
disciples, and
The occupying military officer.
the
Yeah.
disciples are not happy about this.
Not at all. I mean, and again, and why would an occupying Roman military officer who crucifies Jews like Jesus for a living, why would he seek out some local homeless Jewish mystic faith healer to come to his home to heal a common slave? Except when you read the Greek translation, they don't use the word slave, they use the word pais, which could be translated as beloved boy. And what do we know about the Romans? We know they kept their wives at home when they went on their military assignments. And a lot of these big shots would have a young boy they brought with them because, as long as you're the one doing the penetrating, it's totally chill and there's no hangups about it. And so we know that this guy may have done that. That's common. Shucks, the Vatican seems to have a little bit of a problem with the same sort of thing lingering into this century, doesn't it? Those Romans. So it makes a lot more sense that this guy sought out the mystic homeless faith healer because he loved this person that was dying. And Jesus right away is so impressed. And these are the bad guys. These are the guys who crucified Jesus. It wasn't the Jews. It was literally centurions who murdered Jesus physically, literally these guys. And Jesus is like, "Your faith is solid, man. He's already healed. I don't have to come to your house." The apostles must have been thrilled about this. I mean, and then in Matthew 19, where they try to trip him up on divorce law, they're trying to use this right now. Male and female, he made them, right? That's their big argument. The homophobes, Mike Huckabee, male and female, he made them. Matthew 19, Jesus says, man leaves his wife. Well, that's not Jesus coming out against gay marriage. It's Jesus coming out against straight divorce. Because under the old law, a man could toss his wife to the curb whenever he felt like it. You want to get divorced? I divorce you. That's it. No lawyers. She has no power. She also isn't allowed to get educated or have a job. So divorce could be a death sentence for women. If women didn't have a family to go live with, it was homelessness or prostitution. It was a death sentence. So for Jesus, when they say, "Can a man divorce his wife for any reason?" in Matthew 19, when you read the whole story in context, which Mike Huckabee is counting on you not doing, Jesus says to them, "No, Moses had these laws, and because your hearts were hardened, you did this." He calls out Moses for being hard-hearted. And he says, if you throw your wife out for any reason other than she cheated on you, you're committing adultery and making her commit adultery. And the apostles were like, holy crap, we can't just dump our wives anymore. Maybe it's better to never get married. And Jesus is like, well, I'm sorry, man, but I got to tell you one more thing. And then he says, he changes the law, right? He completely overturns the divorce law of Moses because he has a new covenant. He's like, I'm the guy telling you how it is now. But then he says, there's three kinds of guys my divorce law doesn't apply to. And it's the three kind of guys that are never going to be getting divorced. Because these are the three kind of guys that are never going to be getting married. And these three kinds of guys, he uses the umbrella term eunuch. Eunuchs are never going to be getting married. And there's three types of eunuchs. The ones who were born eunuchs, the ones who were made eunuchs by men, and the ones who became eunuchs for the glory of God. Meaning, in reverse order, became for the glory of God, they're celibate. They're ascetics out living in the dead. They're
Like your
religious.
dad originally.
Like my dad promised he would and then slipped up. Made eunuchs by men, castrated. Those who are born eunuchs, Jesus isn't talking about the incredibly tiny number of boys born without genitals. He's talking about boys who are born, and you know from the beginning that these boys just aren't going to be marrying ladies someday. And then Jesus goes off to pray with some kids, and it's all chill, and no one's freaked out about it because that's how it is, and Jesus isn't a jerk to gay people. He says it. He says it. Gay men are born that way. Find me another definition that makes more sense than that.
So it's interesting that in the fundy mega churches, you have these groups for divorced guys, but the gay people get kicked to the curb.
Yeah, and again, by the way, I don't think Jesus today would have hang-ups about divorce. I mean, 2,000 years later, back then, divorce could be a death sentence for a woman, but now being forced to stay in an abusive situation can be a death sentence for a woman. You know, when Mother Teresa traveled to Ireland in her frail state to argue against lifting the ban on divorce, I was like, no, it's not the same world that Jesus lived in. And there's women now who will die if they can't get away from a certain man. No. The freedom's more important. Jesus is the biggest feminist in the Bible. The biggest feminist in the Bible. I have a whole chapter on it. He empowers women like nobody else in the whole book, certainly not Paul, and certainly not who came before him. And so, you know, to me, that issue is just yeah, I can't believe these right-wingers pretend to follow this guy.
Well, the book is Separation of Church and Hate: A Sane Person's Guide to Taking Back the Bible from Fundamentalists, Fascists, and Flock-Fleecing Frauds. The author is comedian, actor, and broadcaster John Fugelsang. John, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show.
SW, what a great pleasure. Thank you and your listeners so much for having me.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about you and the book, where would they look?
You can follow me on all the social medias at John Fugelsang, which is hard to spell, Fugelsang. I have a Substack and a website. I anchor the evening programming on SiriusXM's Progress Channel 127. If you have SiriusXM, you can always hear me on demand or on the app. And if you don't, the best parts of our show are a free podcast every day called the John Fugelsang Podcast. So come on down and say hi.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. Before we go, I'd like to thank our listeners for your help during KBOO's Out Loud membership drive. If you didn't get a chance to contribute, this community radio station could still use your support. We mentioned already that the billionaire class has succeeded in their efforts to kill off the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but you still have the power to keep the last of our public airwaves out of the hands of the oligarchs. And supporting KBOO Community Radio is a great start. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/words and pictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.